Chapter 49. Packing and Printing. Fine, clear weather. Not very cold. Took photographs of Kanchenjunga. Climbed up to Observatory Hill. Took more photographs. Though on the whole, Mahakala Shrine, etc., rather disappointing. Thus my diary. Terry and I were not in Kalimpong, but in Darjeeling, having arrived there early that morning. Darjeeling was 8,000 feet above sea level, as compared to Kalimpong's 4,000 feet. And the visitor who had the good fortune to be there on a clear day had an unobstructed view of the glittering wall of perpetual snow that was Kanchenjunga. The weather being clear that morning, Terry and I lost no time in walking up to the Charastra, and thence to the moor, from where we climbed to the top of Observatory Hill, stopping on the way from time to time to get our breath, and to photograph the white mass that towered 20,000 feet above us, majestic against the blue. Having circumambulated the untidy Mahakala Shrine, sacred to Buddhists and Hindus alike, we made our way back to the Charastra, to the bookshops and curio stores, and so to the GPO, for while we were glad to have had a better view of Kanchenjunga than was possible from Kalimpong, it was not really for the sake of the view that we were in Darjeeling that day. We were there to send a cable to Christmas Humphreys. I had written to Toby shortly after replying to Goulstone's letter, assuring him that I would be returning to England despite the Trust's decision regarding me, and asking for his comments or advice. He had replied at once and at some length, and my cable was in response to his letter, which had reached me the previous day. I was sending the cable from Darjeeling because I did not want its contents to become common property, as would certainly have been the case had I sent it from Kalimpong, and because I wanted to make sure that it would reach Toby before the Sangha Association's AGM, which he had said he would be attending, and at which his was bound to be an influential voice. The cable did not say everything I wanted to say, but it made my position sufficiently clear. Thank you, support, stop. Glad you realise no evidence, main allegation, stop. Not interested image, interested enlightenment, supporters likewise, stop. Better split than united mediocrity, stop. Vihara tactics, disgraceful, stop. AGM opportunity, good purge, stop. Wonder if you dare, stop. No intention being sacrificed, combination Hinayana sterility, British respectability, stop. Not all your facts correct. Writing immediately. Stop. Good luck. As was evident from the tenor of my cable, Toby's letter had been concerned mainly with the question of my image. After acknowledging that the situation was tragic in the extreme, he had gone on to say that the trustee's decision was final, that it would not be affected by the views of the Sangha Association, that the magnificent work I had done for the Dharma was not enough, and that I had to face the depth and power of the English middle-class mind and its abhorrence of homosexuality. There was no question of any offences. It was the image I had created that was the real cause of the present crisis. This was the clearest indication I had yet received that the Trust's decision had something to do with my friendship with Terry, for I could not but assume that it was to this that Toby was alluding when he spoke of the image I had created. There was little doubt that he was in a position to understand the depth and power of the English middle-class mind, and in particular, its abhorrence of homosexuality. Had not his father been junior prosecuting counsel at the trial of Oscar Wilde in 1895? Not that Toby himself was a man of illiberal views. There were homosexuals of high character and ability in the Buddhist movement in England, his letter continued, but the Buddhist public did not notice them as such, and were no more offended by them than by the presence of someone they were privately informed to be an alcoholic. In my case, however, it was my public image, my visible way of life, that was in question. A fair analogy would be the behaviour of a vicar in a small Church of England parish. Suppose he was often drunk on church occasions, or spent most of his time in bookmakers' offices, or flaunted a mistress, or were known to show blue films to his friends in private. The scandal would mean that he had to go on the ground that his congregation was gravely upset by his conduct. I had been astounded when I came to this part of Toby's reply and told him as much in the letter, which I sent from Darjeeling along with the cable. There was not the remotest resemblance between my behaviour and that of his Church of England vicar. The worst that could be said of me was that I handled money, that I sometimes took solid food after midday, and that I wore my hair a little longer than was customary. Toby subsequently had the grace to retract the analogy, in effect admitting that he had allowed words to run away with him, as I had bluntly told him was the case. Nonetheless, I could not help wondering what kind of stories Walsh and perhaps others had been circulating about me. The cable having been sent and my letter posted, Terry and I walked round the Chowk Bazaar, bought some cloth for the woodblock prints we had started making, and visited the Tibetan Self-Help Centre, where we saw some very beautiful but very expensive handmade rugs. Our day in Darjeeling ended with tea at Keventinus, a popular local rendezvous, after which we returned to Kalimpong and to a week of packing and printing, and to what De Quincey would have called 1,000 final or farewell farewells. According to the Vinaya, the individual monk might possess only 8 things: his 3 robes, a bowl, a razor, a needle, a girdle, and a water strainer. In the course of my 14 years in Kalimpong, however, I had managed to accumulate a couple of 100 books on Buddhism and other subjects, as well as various images, tankers, ritual bells, etc. These would all be of use to the new Buddhist movement I would now be starting in England, and for the last week or more, Terry and I had been packing them into the black steel trunks Lobsang had bought in the bazaar, together with such diaries and notebooks as I thought worth keeping. On top we placed, partly by way of filling, the wood block prints we'd been making, and which we continued to make almost until the day of our departure. I had 4 or 5 such woodblocks depicting White Tara and other divinities, and it was from these that Terry and I had made our first rather experimental prints on Tibetan handmade paper and on the brightly coloured cloths we had bought. We had also borrowed Dada Rinpoche's woodblocks. The prints would make good presents for our friends in England, we thought. It might also be possible for us to sell them at the Buddhist groups we would be visiting, along with the malas and other religious requisites we had been buying in Varanasi and other places along the way, as well as in Kalimpong itself. One day I remembered that the local Gelug monastery had a large collection of woodblocks of various kinds, and that for a small fee it was possible to get prints made from them. My connection with the monastery went back to 1951, when, in the company of Marco Pallas, the author of Peaks and Lamas, I had called on the ancient Kenpo, or abbot, and invited him and his monks to collaborate in the reception I was organising for the relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Moggallana, the Buddha's chief disciples, which were then touring India and the Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia. That collaboration had been gladly given, and over the years my relations with the monastery had become increasingly cordial. They had been particularly cordial since 1961, when I had organised the first public celebration of Tsongkhapa's death anniversary to be held in Kalimpong. The celebration was a great success, including as it did a grand procession through the town and a public meeting at which the principal speaker was Tijang Rinpoche, the Dalai Lama's junior tutor. This resulted in my becoming very much persona grata at the monastery, as well as with the wider Tibetan community, while the Tsongkhapa anniversary became a regular feature of the town's religious calendar. On my return, I was pleased to find that during my absence, the anniversary had been celebrated, albeit on a reduced scale, and that this year, too, there was to be a procession and a public meeting in honour of the great Tibetan reformer. The celebration was held 2 weeks later, enabling Terry to see something of the more popular, colourful side of Tibetan Buddhism. The procession followed the same route as in previous years, starting from the monastery, which was situated a mile or more from the town. It made its way down the hill to the upper bazaar, circumambulated the Mela ground, and returned to the monastery by the back road. Terry and I had stationed ourselves at a spot half a mile below the monastery, from which we could see the procession as it passed down the winding, dusty track. First came 2 8-foot copper trumpets, each of them blown by one monk and supported on the shoulder of another. After the trumpets came a long line of monks wearing ceremonial robes of rich brocade, some carrying banners of victory, others playing drums, oboes and conch shells. These were followed by monks wearing the usual maroon robes, lay devotees in traditional dress, and Tibetan schoolchildren. Lastly, borne in a golden palanquin under a huge umbrella of yellow silk, came the famous gold image of Tsongkhapa, which reputedly had the power to speak. An hour and a half later, the procession having arrived back at the monastery, the public meeting was held in the courtyard in front of the main building. The monks chanted verses of blessing, and I spoke about Buddhism in England, at the same time announcing that I would shortly be leaving Kalimpong again, this time for good. Terry had taken many pictures of the procession. On our arrival at the monastery in quest of woodblock prints, therefore, the monks were not surprised to see him with me, and we were both given a warm welcome. It was not long before the woodblocks were brought out, or before 4 or 5 monks were busy inking them, placing a sheet of paper or a length of cloth on the inked surface and pressing it evenly against the woodblock with the aid of a heavy wooden roller. The print was then peeled off and hung up to dry. The monastery's woodblocks were of many shapes and sizes and depicted not only Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but the Wheel of Life, mandalas of various kinds, and magic diagrams, while some also contained mantras and prayers in bold Tibetan script. After a while, Terry and I noticed that not all the prints that were being produced were good enough either to give us presents or to sell. Some were smudged, some unevenly inked, and some not properly aligned with the paper or cloth on which they were printed. Terry therefore suggested that he should try his hand at producing a few prints, to which the monks laughingly agreed, obviously thinking that it would be a great joke to see what a mess the inexperienced Englishman made of the job. To their amazement, Terry smilingly produced print after perfect print, so that in the end, the laugh was very much on them rather than on him. Thereafter, my friend and I paid several more visits to the monastery, each time taking with us a fresh supply of coloured cloth. The result was that thanks to the combined efforts of the monks, as well as to Terry's more skilled exertions, we eventually had over 100 good prints to take with us back to England. Terry enjoyed making the prints at the monastery and enjoyed the company of the monks, with whom he seemed to be quite at home. Indeed, these sessions at the Gelug Monastery were probably the happiest part of his time in Kalimpong, even as our stay in Kalimpong itself was probably for him the happiest part of our whole India tour. Only once during those 4 or 5 weeks did he become seriously depressed, despite the fact that his darkening had proved to be no less elusive there than elsewhere. "Do you think I shall meet my darkening today?" had been his frequent cry during the early weeks of our tour, but now he was silent on the subject, as if realising that his hope of meeting her was an impossible dream. A few dozen yards from the main building, half screened by trees, There stood a cottage that seemed to be part of the monastery and yet not part of it. This was the abode of Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, whom Terry and I had already met, and who, on the day of the Tsongkhapa anniversary, had given us lunch. The Rinpoche was short and slightly built, and although then in his late 20s, he had the physique of a boy of 12 or 14. At the same time, his bearing and manners were those of an old man, while his pale face had a waxen look. A slight smile, as if of amusement, usually hovered about his lips, and when he spoke it was in a low voice, but with a quiet authority that commanded instant obedience from servants and disciples alike. Around him there was a certain atmosphere, almost an aura. This was perhaps due not so much to his own mysterious personality as to his having inherited the reputation and prestige of the previous Tomo Geshe Rinpoche, the celebrated yogi about whose wonder-working powers I had written briefly in A Survey of Buddhism. I had known Geshe Rinpoche, as he was generally called, since 1961. Imprisoned by the Chinese in the aftermath of the 1959 Lhasa uprising, he'd been released thanks to the intervention of the government of India, and after a short stay in Gangtok, had settled in Kalimpong. Soon he was studying English with me at the Vihara, and in this way we'd become good friends. Terry took a liking to the Rinpoche, and the Rinpoche seemed to take a liking to him, and we spent many pleasant hours in his company. Besides showing us the inner room where his renowned predecessor had been accustomed to meditate, he allowed Terry to take pictures of his most sacred images, as well as of himself. Our last week in Kalimpong was a busy one. By the end of it, however, Terry and I had finished packing the last of the black steel trunks, had produced the last of our prints, and had paid farewell visits to Dada Rinpoche and Yogi Chen, as well as to Geshe Rinpoche, the Kazi and Kazini, and other friends. I was particularly sorry to be parting from Dada Rinpoche, and he, I believe, was sorry to be parting from me. At all events, in the course of the week, he came to the Vihara twice, the first time being to attend the farewell tea party I was giving. Geshe Rinpoche, Sherab Nangma, the Kazini, Uncle Joe and Mrs. King were also present on this occasion, as were several of my Nepalese former students. Quite a pleasant little gathering, my diary records, though Kazini, as usual, struck a rather jarring note. Dada Rinpoche stayed behind after the others had gone and gave me 1,000 small prints of the three long-life divinities, the Buddha Amitayus, White Tara, and the goddess Vijaya. 2 days later he came again, bringing more presents, two fox tails for me, a traditional Tibetan gift, and a silk applique picture for Terry. The following day, Wednesday the 28th of December, was the day of our departure. In the morning we went and paid our last visit to Dada Rinpoche, and I bade him a final farewell. Though I was sorry to leave him, I knew that I could never really be parted from him, any more than I could be parted from Yogi Chen or Kachi Rinpoche or any of my other teachers. Spiritually speaking, they would always be with me, and I with them, and I would always have their protection and blessing. A few hours later, Terry and I were on our way.